Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello and welcome back to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Teresa and today I'm joined by Stephanie, Nicola, Linda and Heather.
Hello. Hi.
I'd like to say hello to all our listeners in Sydney. We'd love to know you better, so if you feel like joining our Facebook group and letting us know what you're reading or writing, that would be fabulous. This week, we're talking about transmedia and children's brands. We interviewed John Lomas Bullivant from Kickback Media. Nicola will be sharing her work in progress with us. And Heather and Judith Hennigan will be telling us what's on their bedside tables. Stephanie will be exploring some more interesting idioms. But first, Linda will ask us to
name the novel.
I will. Pencils, poems?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, clue number one. Published in 2006 and a New York Times bestseller the same year, this novel began during NaNoWriMo.
Ooh!
It's told largely in flashbacks. The first line reads, I am 90 or 93, one or the other.
Ooh, it's a great opening line, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Two. The author notes, the idea for this book came unexpectedly. In early 2003, I was gearing up to write an entirely different book when the Chicago Tribune ran an article on Edward J. Kelly, a photographer who followed traveling circuses around America in the 1920s and 30s. Everybody's writing.
I know.
Shall we do clue three?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, was that? I thought that was one.
Set in the circus world in 1932, the main character, Jacob, was ready to set for his final exams when he was suddenly orphaned. He hops a train, which happens to be carrying a circus that is struggling to survive in the Depression years. When the circus boss learns that he studied to be a vegetarian.
Can you say vet?
When the circus boss learns that he is a vet, he puts Jacob in charge of caring for the circus menagerie. Along the way, Jacob falls in love with Marlena, the horse trainer, as well as with the animals he cares for, especially Rosie, a seemingly untrainable bull elephant who only understands Polish.
I remember the book. I don't remember the author's name.
Oh.
It's got to be the thing that The Greatest Showman's been based on, hasn't it?
This is a 2003 book. I don't know.
No, 2006.
2006. So uh-huh. It's a 21st century book. I don't know. Is anybody else got anything?
I was thinking it must be the one that the film The Greatest Showman's based on.
Oh, I don't know. Is that a recent film? I don't know.
Yeah. You've missed The Greatest Showman?
I haven't seen it.
But
Is it Water for Elephants?
Yes,
and
it
I can't
is.
Remember the author's
yes,
name.
Yes, it is, Teresa. The author is Sarah Gruen.
All right. I remember reading it.
Yeah.
I don't think it is the basis for The Greatest Showman.
No, I don't think it is.
Okay. Sounds good, though, doesn't it?
It was a number one New York Times bestseller in hardback and again in paperback.
Oh, there's another blooming book going on to my what's it.
I'm not going to add anything to my syndicate until I've cleared the one I've got.
Well done, you.
But it was also a bestseller on Wall Street Journal, Newsday, favorite book, USA Today, Barnes & Noble bestseller. It just went everywhere. And then it was a motion picture starring Reese Witherspoon.
Oh,
so and the author tells very interesting stories. She made millions of dollars, of course.
Mm-hmm.
She said it's enabled her to buy a house and land where they can keep two horses, dogs, cats, birds, and the world's fussiest goat because she loves animals. So
great. Yeah.
And since that time, she's gone on to write more novels. And I think the third one was again a bestseller.
Wow. Good for her.
Good for her. Yeah. Yeah, very good. As I recall, it was a good book. I think I enjoyed reading it.
Oh, I did.
Thank you, Linda. Now, it's over to Nicola for her latest instalment in The Adventures of Brienne.
Well, I think I might have read part of this to you before, but since our feature on erotic writing, I've decided I cannot go and write a book that doesn't have any elements of love story in at all. So I also wanted to look at some of my chapters where nothing really happened in them and make something happen in the middle of them, because I now know that's a good thing to do. So we're going for that with this. Beyond the plateau where they sat, a deep tree-filled gorge dropped away before rising on the other side towards a huge mountain. Brienne looked towards the sparkling sea, far away to the left and much lower than the plateau, then back at the mountain. There's something very odd about that mountain. She propped herself against a tree, lowering her eyes again so as not to attract attention. Where was she? What on earth was she wearing? Looking down at her grubby, rough clothes, she tried in vain to identify any of the stains marking the front of her once blue tunic. Her lower legs were bare and rather hairy, and her feet tied into worn old sandals made of thin strips of leather. Her feet? No, they were the feet of a peasant, very dusty with dirty toenails. It was the feet together with the hairy legs that made Brienne realise that not only was she very far from Rex's balcony, but that she was not even still in her own body. In an effort not to cry out with surprise, she bore herself time by looking up at the mountain again and realised immediately that it didn't look like any mountain she'd ever seen. It looked more like a grass and shrub-covered pyramid, but it was enormous, bigger than the pyramids in Egypt she'd visited with Alec once. It loomed over the little group of people, even though it was on the other side of the gorge and several miles away. She stood up and walked slowly over the path to the edge of the plateau and gazed at the huge mountain. It really was most odd how very regular it looked. As she stood there, a wave of dizziness came over her and she reached out her hand to lean on the nearest olive tree. The feeling of falling was immediate and overwhelming as the tree roots came loose from their crumbly soil, and both Brienne and the tree headed into the gorge. Suddenly a vice-like grip grabbed her wrist and painfully yanked her back into safety, and she watched in horror as the tree bounced down the gorge, turning over and over as it fell. "What are you thinking, Stella? You know the ground is all dried up and roots can't be counted on to hold firm. Why were you so near the edge of the gorge anyway?" The tall warrior held her too close with his other arm, and his eyes blazed as he shouted at her. "I just wanted to get a better look at that mountain." "What for, you mad woman? You see it nearly every day of your life. What's so interesting all of a sudden that you would risk your life for it?" "Oh, sorry, I'm sorry. I'll be more careful. I'm sorry." "Don't shout at her, Adonis. Look, she's shaking. Let me get her a drink." Panos's mother had come over and gently disentangled his hands. She led Brienne back to the shade. Brienne looked back over her shoulder to see Adonis glare at her before returning to join the other men by the fire. When they were out of earshot, she whispered, "Never you mind him, Stella. You know he's sweet on you. He just got scared when he saw you toppling over. You can't say he's slow acting in any other way, though. He moved like lightning to grab you."
Yeah, an exciting scene.
It is. I like good muscles that can move like lightning to grab you.
Well, I think if it's about, you know, the sort of frisson between them, whatever, I think you could do a little bit more with that, build that up a little bit, because it is just basically that one, you know, where he held her too close and his eyes blazed. And, you know, but what is she feeling? Is she feeling like her blood's running faster or her heart's beating?
It was so hard. I was so worried
but
about
we need
going
to know,
too
we
far.
We do need to know that Brienne feels something at that moment, a tingle or a, you know, a spark. Yeah.
I made a note of when he held her too close, which was, too close was a good word. It said the tall warrior held her too close with his other arm and his eyes blazed as he shouted at her. I agree with what Teresa said, but I also thought you could show us that he's tall by having her face feeling the roughness of his tunic against her face.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Something like that. And also,
it was really tall then.
Well, or whatever.
She could tilt her chin up, so shout at
her. Yeah, she could feel something. But if we could then feel, and she could feel slightly breathless and warm or something like that, you know, if we start to feel what she's feeling.
I'm sure you'd get sweaty if I'd
the tall warrior held her too close and his eyes blazed as he shouted at her. I think that, you know, that bit could do with a bit more.
Beefing up.
Yeah, it's just that.
And the other bit that I've highlighted was the feeling of falling was immediate and overwhelming as the tree roots came loose from their crumbly soil and both Brienne and the tree headed into
That's
the gorge.
Long sentence.
Said I like the feeling of that falling was immediate and overwhelming, but I think you could add a great deal of impact by writing that paragraph more slowly. And I will lend you a snippet out of a book called Glass by Alex Christofi, where somebody feels himself, he's wearing a harness, but he's on the spire of Salisbury Cathedral. He feels himself falling off. And there's a whole paragraph about that 1 second of the feeling of falling, and it's tremendous. Mm. And you know that expression, right, slow bits fast and the fast bits slow? Yeah. I think this is a fast bit that you could write really slowly and really have her, have us with her suspended in midair, not knowing what's going to happen, because it's quite a dramatic thing. And it also, it's quite a critical moment because it precipitates Adonis's rescue of her, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So she can feel her things going, you know, her feet going and starting to fall. And then you can help us feel.
Yeah, because we need time for him to get across from the fire, don't we?
Well, no, I'm not suggesting she literally is going to hang in midair, but I think if you had us hanging in midair with her,
yes,
you could have her feet start to go. Because you said the feeling of falling was immediate and overwhelming as the tree roots came loose, but presumably her feet would have been scrabbling and, you know, and I think, as I say, I will send you that passage because I think that
it's great.
That's a passage that could really be beefed up. Mm. And then he comes and gets her. So it's almost a little story in itself, just that paragraph about her beginning to fall.
Yeah. Mm. I read a thing recently where someone was toppled in, it was a sci-fi book, I can't remember which one, but she was thrown into a vat of something, and what she didn't realise was that as you throw into the vat, you drop through into another world. And as she was dropping through into the other world and flying through the sky, the way they wrote that was just like that.
Yeah.
It was really...
Yeah.
It took about 5 minutes to tell how it felt.
Exactly, and I think that's the point I'm making. I think that is a fast bit that you could write really slowly and really give some impact, because it is the moment that she meets Adonis and the reason that she meets him, isn't it? Just a couple of points. I counted in those 500 and odd words, I counted 7 mountains, 3 plateaus, 5 gorges, 3 trees and 2 pyramids. There's a mountain, there's a plateau, there's a gorge, and there's some trees. But I think, you know, it might be that we find other words for those or whatever. Just a suggestion. But anyway, there's my notes.
Getting a bit hung up on the geography.
No. I mean, it's fine. I just think, huge mountain.
Completely, yes.
Look down to the plateau, then back at the mountain. There's something odd about that mountain. You know, we get it. Yeah. It's a mountain.
And it's shaped like a pyramid.
Nicola is under the table here with laughter. I don't know what's happening
there. That's so funny.
These criticisms. I loved the plotting. I loved her so much about it. I loved her hairy legs and her toenails.
And her self-disgust.
But then I also had a couple of things here that caught my eye. When she's looking up at the mountain again, she realized immediately that it didn't look like any mountain she'd ever seen. However, I think that up here, we've got that already, there is something very odd about that mountain. Mm. So for her to realize immediately that it didn't look like. But maybe if you just took away the realizing immediately and just say it didn't look like any mountain she'd ever seen or something, or any uprising that was
any lump of rock
that was caused by a long ago volcano or something.
Any elevation of the topography was
looking for synonyms for mountain. Any suggestions, do let us know.
Panos' mother has come over.
She needs a name, doesn't she?
Yeah, because I've said here, when they were out of earshot, she whispered, never you mind him. But I thought, who whispered at that point? Because there's been a bit since said between the introduction.
But how does she know who she is, who Panos is and who Panos' mother is?
Oh, because she's... Panos is a little toddler who brought her the drink over earlier. It's in a
I thought she'd just arrived in this body. I was totally confused. No, I don't know who anybody is.
You've heard the other bits before.
Yes, I have. But it was just that, you know, you say that, where was she? What on earth was she wearing? Like, this has all just happened. So that's why I thought we were...
When you have to chop out 500 words to...
The context, because you're saying, she, in an effort not to cry out with surprise, you know, at who she is, where she is, what she is, but suddenly she knows who the people are. She's never seen that mountain before. She's never seen this landscape before.
Never seen her body before.
But she knows who Panos' mother is. So that struck me as odd.
I get
so
you.
I think... Yeah. You know, maybe
it needs a lot of work.
There's a continuity.
Yeah. No, it needs a bit of work. You know, it's just a,
It's also interesting to me because I've never ever written anything and then gone back before.
Yes.
And I've never gone back and tried to add things in and do the continuity thing. And I'm, you know, it's an interesting experiment.
It really is, and it's quite hard to keep track of it. Or just why I have a spreadsheet and I'm still getting in a mess.
But you know what? I think we're always saying, don't edit while you're doing. Just keep.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Leave those things for later when you go back.
Put these notes in a pile.
These brightly coloured notes.
Well, that's because I've highlighted every instance of mountain, every instance of gorge.
Lovely. Oh, you can't see it out there in listener land, but the mountain where she's coloured in blue. Yeah. And I don't
the gorge is pink.
What's that?
And the plateau is yellow, so it's a highly attractive piece of paper.
And I also, something which pulled me up, suddenly a vice-like grip grabbed her wrist and painfully yanked her back to safety. Who was it painful for? The vice-like grip?
Oh, not again.
It's one of those, yeah, is yeah, it? Because yeah. I immediately thought, painful eyes. For who?
Yeah.
But anyway,
I'm good. This is all good feedback. Thank you very much. Keep going forward. I'm saving all this. And the whole point of this work in progress, but it's not to say go back and do it now, but when you come to do edits, it's just what other people have spotted for you.
Very organisedly.
Well, I have said that I love it. I absolutely love everything about the Taurus trilogy so far. I think you're plotting on this and just the creation of the story that you've done with so much to keep track of in this time traveling and falling through worlds and things is amazing. And I'm really anxious to read more. I always want to read more when I finish these. So
there we go. You can't ask more than that, can you? Thank you very much.
I liked it very much. I got confused at the beginning about whether this was the first time she'd come into this body.
Oh, yes, it is, yes.
So, yeah. I just got a little bit muddled up.
This is reading things out of context, isn't it? It's quite a difficult
story. It is. But we have to kind of critique what we've got.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you, Nicola. Now, Stephanie, it's over to you.
Yes, I thought I would look today at how we use numbers in idioms. An idiom is where we kind of use an expression, Nicola, because you said earlier on what's an idiom,
sure,
right?
Yes.
So, for example, we might say, oh, he's all at sixes and sevens, or I was in a two and eight, or they're dressed to the nines. So Don't steal my thunder.
You know how Linda likes to
explain everything, Linda. Don't you worry.
Okay.
So I'm looking today at numbers in idioms. So the easy one, two and eight. A two and eight. If I said to you, Linda, some tea leaf made off with me skin and blisters purse, which had a monkey and Lady Godiva's in it, and she's in a right two and eight. Do you understand what I was saying?
Absolutely not. That's the one that got me. Sixes and sevens I can figure out, but two and eight?
Two and eight is a state. So what I actually said was some tea leaf, some thief, made off with me skin and blisters, my sister's purse, which had a monkey, £500, in Lady Godiva's fivers in it. So some thief has made away with my sister's purse, which has £500 in fivers in it, and she's in a right state.
Okay.
A two and eight is a state.
Okay.
That's an easy one.
Slang, but also it refers to old currency.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
2 shillings and 8 pence.
And what was the Lady Godiva thing?
Five pound note.
Oh.
Is a Lady Godiva.
Like George Washington.
Yes, exactly. On a $1 bill, you have a Washington. Yeah, exactly. Or a blue on the new $100 bill because it's got a blue hue. Anyway, maybe we'll do money idioms another time. So two and eight's an easy one. It's Cockney rhyming slang for being in a state. But being at sixes and sevens is a little bit different because that means it's not in a state, but it's a little bit disorientated or
confused.
And so I wondered, well, where do sixes and sevens come from? Because it certainly isn't rhyming slang. So I did some research and there was a few conflicting ideas. The Oxford English Dictionary supports the suggestion that it was a corruption of sunk and cease in French, and the whole it was about a dice game with a five and a six, and if you risked a lot of money on throwing high dice, you were set on song can cease, and that was somehow adulterated into you were set on sixes and sevens. And it is actually mentioned, sixes and sevens in terms of dice is mentioned in Chaucer's Troilus and Cressida, 1374. Ooh. So that is a possibility, and the Oxford English Dictionary does support that. That would have been about risk, and today, to be at sixes and sevens is more about a state of confusion and or disorder than of risk. Another suggestion for the etymology of the phrase is the biblical text of, you'll like this one, Linda. The King James Version of the Bible in Job 15:12 says, "He shall deliver thee six in troubles, yea, in seven there shall no evil touch thee."
And
Chaucer might have been familiar with the Latin text of that Bible, so he might have come up with sixes and sevens.
I don't know what you were talking about. what did the scripture say?
The scripture says, "He shall deliver thee in six troubles, yea, in seven there shall no evil touch thee." But it would have had to have morphed from being a problem and a risk into being a confusion. So it's all a mystery.
It's like
at sixes and sevens is still a mystery. I've looked everywhere.
Yep. Supreme being has thrown the dice, and if you get a six, you're going to be in trouble. If you get a seven, nothing's going to touch you. Is that?
Well, you can't get a seven when you throw dice.
Depends how many dice.
Well, I suppose,
with two dice, you will get a seven more often than not.
Right.
So the bottom line is, all at sixes and sevens is a mystery, and if anybody knows it,
we'd love to know.
We'd love to know.
Tell us all about it.
Now let's come to the number nine, because there's a couple of idioms about the number nine. We talk about the whole nine yards and dress to the nines. Okay, well, there's a theory about those. It is said that tailors used 9 yards of fabric to make a suit.
Mm.
Although, to be honest,
sounds a lot,
doesn't it?
Can I give you another one? 9 tailors make a man?
Yes. Yeah. That's from, and I haven't actually taken all the notes of that one because I thought it would be too long. I have got it here.
Well, I think it was basically, you know, tailors used to sit cross-legged on the floor and sew, and it was perhaps considered not a very manly occupation. But I do remember reading that Queen Elizabeth I gave an audience to 18 tailors on one occasion and said, "Good morning, gentlemen, both," because 9 tailors make a man. One man.
Yeah.
I wonder if it could be that the process of making a suit took 9 tailors if they were working, each doing one task.
It could be.
I wonder how Teresa knows that and remembers it.
I read it in a book.
I've got it on a piece of paper, but I put it in the bin. I thought I would leave that bit out, but so I'm glad you covered it. Okay, in 1835, in Samuel Fellowes' The Progressive Dictionary of the English Language, it was suggested that it might be an alteration of "dress to thine eyes." Because that was an expression to mean, you know, dressed flamboyantly and extravagantly.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not really, it's only a suggestion, there's not really any supporting evidence.
That makes sense, though, doesn't it? Misheard changes over time.
Yeah.
And we know that as early as 1719, "to the nines" was used with regard to clothing. And before that, it was "to the nines" was used to indicate perfection. There's lots of biblical and medieval records about things being in the nines. From 1719, it was definitely used in regard to being clothed beautifully. So it's another mystery, I'm afraid.
I don't know where they came from.
Well, I'm going to keep looking, but if anybody else has got any theories, I'd certainly like to hear them.
Maybe we should write to Susie Dent.
Maybe we should.
Who is Susie Dent?
Oh, well, she's a bit of a television personality in the UK, but she works for the Oxford English Dictionary, or she did. She's a lexicographer, but she's on a quiz show called Countdown, and she does the meanings and origins of words. Right.
There's also Radio 4. There's a Radio 4 programme. I can't remember what it's called. Right. I wrote to them once before. They couldn't answer my question. Mm. But anyway.
And if you've got any good Cockney rhyming slang for Linda, do send it in, because we love to tease with that, don't we?
And I'd like to remind all of you around this table that 49% of our listeners are in the United States. That's right.
Yep, true. It's very true. So maybe next time it's my turn, I'll do something for the people in the States.
Well, maybe people in the United States could send something on the Facebook page.
Yeah.
Or the group.
Yeah.
And let us know some
expressions that we won't understand.
Yeah, we could call it "Fool the Brits."
Yeah. Why not? Brilliant. Thank you, Stephanie. In a moment, we're going to hear our interview with John Lomas Bullivant from Kickback Media. But I just thought I'd give you a little bit of background as to how I came into contact with John. Some of you know about this, but some of you won't. So last year, about 6 months ago, I entered a competition which was run by the Writers and Artists Yearbook, and John Lomas Bullivant was one of the judges. And the competition was to write a scene of up to 2,000 words aimed at a 10-year-old reader with a 12-year-old protagonist, and it had to be non-realistic, so it could be fantasy, dystopian, future, sci-fi, whatever. And there were various other criteria for this competition. And I was long-listed. I didn't make the shortlist, I didn't win. But when I was long-listed, I was contacted by John Lomas Bullivant, who asked me lots of probing questions about where the story was going and investigated the world that I was creating. And so I thought he'd be an interesting person to talk to for the podcast. He's been in children's media for 30 years, and he's very interested in children's brands and in stories which will transcend media. So stories which could start in book form, go into TV, go into video games, that sort of thing. And Stephanie and I had a very interesting chat.
We certainly did, yeah.
We're delighted to welcome John Lomas Bullivant, author of the Captain Mac books and TV series and founder of Kickback Media. Welcome, John. Thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure.
John, Kickback is described as the first children's media company to adopt a transmedia approach. Can you tell us what transmedia means to you?
I set up Kickback Media back in sort of 2002, which was actually sort of pre-digital. So there were no smartphones, there was no Twitter, there was no sort of social media, etc., in terms of being able to access consumers or build a brand. My background had been in a company called Hit Entertainment. They're best known for creating Bob the Builder. And the motivation of the company back then, or anybody in that sector of children's media, was to build essentially a global franchise, a sort of a cash cow brand. They went on to acquire Thomas the Tank Engine. And my observation was is that the key drivers in that sector were a character-based property. Bob is a central character. Thomas is an ensemble piece. If you looked into the toy market, there was sort of Barbie, etc., and other things like Hello Kitty. In a very simplistic way, as I said back in the day, the A point was character, and the end game was how do you get your characters to retail and stay there? Because if your character stays at retail, it becomes essentially a cash cow franchise. You know, Thomas has never gone away. It's dipped. Bob has dipped and sort of been there. Barbie stayed there. Hello Kitty stayed there. And that means in financial terms for a big company, it's worth billions of dollars. And this is what the children's media business is about. And so for transmedia back in the day in 2002, it was going, okay, so this is the business dynamic. Character-led properties can create money. Get them to retail, they stay there, you make a fortune. But my observation was that television only serves certain properties particularly well, others it doesn't. And back then, primarily it was that girls were very poorly served by TV. It was the received wisdom that essentially girls would watch boys' things, but boys would not watch girls' things. So there was always a gender bias towards TV programming that was either 50-50 on a gender balance or would definitely skew more towards boys. So you would get Fireman Sam, you'd get Thomas the Tank Engine, you'd get Bob the Builder, you'd have endless preschool franchises, all had a boy skew. There were no girl equivalents. The broadcasters just wouldn't commission them because boys wouldn't watch a girl skewed franchise. Whatever the girl version of Fireman Sam was going to be, it just didn't exist. It very rarely got commissioned. So my observation was is that if you wanted to create a brand, then you needed to look at other avenues. And at the time, the toy industry or even fashion clothing was a far better way to try and create a girl's brand if you wanted to. And so for me, when I talked about transmedia, what I was thinking was is that you look at the whole market, you look at how best to target your consumer. And I apologize for those people who are offended in terms of targeting children as consumers. I know this in the world of publishing and story writing, etc., is, you know, I can feel people shivering already. But if you're in a publicly traded media company, your objective is to create a brand, a character-based brand based on storytelling that makes shed loads of cash. It's a very honest proposition about that. And so transmedia for me was you need to look at all the ways in which you create a property to communicate with your target audience and then work out what it needs to be in that space. So if you're going to TV, it will be preschool, it's probably boy-led. If you wanted to go for girls, you're probably best targeting at that point through a fashion brand, through actually, ironically, early stages of social media. And therefore, you adapted your creative strategy in that way. So that's why you picked up a line, character is king, not the medium. Because television is medium specific. You're using television to create a character-based property that goes to television and then drops down to retail. Whereas if you go to fashion, you're going straight to retail to try and connect with your users. That isn't what a lot of other people think transmedia is. A lot of other people just think it's basically how do you take your idea, turn it into books, into licensing and merchandising from the point where it starts. Whereas I go, no, you look at what the idea is in its very simplest form and decide where do you start it first. In order to do that, you'd have to be a sort of non-specific medium company. And the big challenge is when you look around the global marketplace, publishers do publishing. Television companies do television. Film companies do film. Clothing companies do clothing. Nobody sits and says we're non-medium specific. We're just about creating brands. How would we then best do that? I did develop a preschool TV series, which was Captain Mac. But back in the day, I also developed a girls' fashion brand. And that was my way of demonstrating what transmedia is. Books have always historically been intriguing to me, or rather the publishing industry has. I've now probably moved on from pursuing my transmedia view of content. Books, I think, are a very unique medium which you create content for. They are obviously clearly sort of story-led. And I think they lend themselves, depending on which bit of the publishing industry you want to target and focus on, they lend themselves to different things. You know, the two extremes are you've got one end, hugely successful picture books, and then at the other, you might move to a very successful middle grade fiction series. They're very different in the dynamic of the story. They're very different in terms of how they're going to play in the broader children's marketplace in terms of what brands that they can develop. In terms of what I was talking about, you know, character is king, not the medium. Actually, it's the younger end, it's picture books that lend themselves more to creating those brands, because a brand in the kids space, in my opinion, is heavily design driven. And once you move into middle grade fiction, you know, your cover is effectively the design. There might be some black and white line art, but you've really moved on from design. Whereas most big global kids brands have got a hugely strong design element to them. And that in publishing tends to play out much more in the picture book world. Yeah, it's the recognizable central character or team. So for publishing, if you're into character brands or into creating a brand, actually you're better off, or if that's something that motivates you in terms of your active creativity, actually picture books are probably the best place to go. But I think they're also the toughest place to go. I think it's absolutely extremely difficult to crack that. And anybody who writes picture book stories successfully, as far as I'm concerned, is a genius, because I have no idea how you achieve that. You know, a strong central character. I mean, the Gruffalo is a brilliant case in point. That story could have been told with a monster. It could have been told with some big bad wolf type character. But, you know, Julie Johnson came up with a completely original name for a character. Didn't have that. It wouldn't have inspired the sort of the illustrations, etc. And it certainly wouldn't have gone anywhere near the amount of success that it's achieved. I mean, I spent a lot of my time in the world of sort of television looking for books to turn into TV series. I've met a lot of the people sort of in the way along my sort of career in terms of publishing. TV is very discriminatory in a what will work and what won't work. And honestly, in terms of 10 books, you're looking at 9 no's from the get-go, probably almost instantaneously. And a lot of it is because you go, it's a cat, it's a cat, it's a bear, it's a bear, it's a dog, it's a dog. And you've seen the cat, bear, dog so many times before. And TV's not looking for any more cats or dogs, because Scooby-Doo has got dogs. You know, TV has one or two characters that sit in that space. whereas publishing can have 50 or 100 and still do reasonable numbers for them. Anybody who comes up with any kind of original character that has a unique name and looks, it could be a mashup of things, instantly jumps to the top of the list in terms of anybody in another space who are looking at brands, because they go, I've not seen that before. That's one tip, is if anybody's seen your character before, you're heading in the wrong direction. It's not easy to come up with something distinctive, but it is easy to come up with another cat character, another dog, another bear. And there's surprising how many out there. And once you get that space, you own it. Like Elmer owns elephants because somebody created the patchwork elephant. Just the brilliant way of going something different within that sort of like space. Mm-hmm. The patchwork giraffe, and go, okay, I've got now the patchwork giraffe. But therein lies the opportunities for people in that space to create character, is to go, how original is this character? And the visual originality, even if you can't, Julia Donaldson can't draw, but she basically painted an original character property that then is birthed in a picture book, but will then look, you know, possibility to move to other media, which is most likely to be television next, or it could be something in the digital space. I think TV these days just means video. It could be somebody takes it and turns it into a song, like the Wonky Donkey. Or somebody does short 2-minute episodes and then it builds and it builds, because that's the joy of YouTube and social media, is that actually things can spread very quickly. That's kind of where I've come from. At the moment, I've sort of evolved from that, I think, in terms of what I'm engaging in. But that kind of thinking still permeates everything. Any idea that I'm involved with, I'm always trying to make it bigger and better, and always think about how is it going to play in other media. And that's usually about, at the end of the day, the emotional connection you make mm-hmm. with your target consumer, whether they're a reader or a viewer. It's pretty much, I'd say, 85% children's. Number one, if you think children's, for me, characters work because kids use those kind of properties, brands, to communicate something about themselves, in my opinion. Whereas adults stop using character-based brands and just use sports brands, car brands, music brands. You've got rugby written on your T-shirt, etc. You know, you're telling the world something about yourself because you're into that particular sport. Other people might go Metallica T-shirt, or they might want to wear a Sex Pistols T-shirt. Each one of those is the same statement type thing that a child has when they go, I'm wearing Dora the Explorer, or I'm wearing Bob the Builder, or I'm wearing Spider-Man, or I'm wearing Batman, mm-hmm. or I'm carrying a pig toy, etc. Just like an adult won't wear a brand that they're not comfortable with because it doesn't feel right for them, so children won't. And when they do, it's a massive endorsement. It says there's something about Peppa Pig that I love, and I want to tell the world that I love this. She stands for me and I stand for her. And that's what a character brand does, that it's aspirational. And so adults, it doesn't have a play in the adult world, with the exception of something like The Simpsons, probably. The rest of it, the brands that get built in story world are more story-led and less about their central character. Mm. They have a big design component in the same way that children's brands do. Right. If you're into a particular detective that's coming through a series of books, Rebus or whatever it is, there's no design component. Every book cover is different. The central character is a human. No one's designed him. If it's turned into video, it's live action. Therefore, it's about the casting. What you hook onto in it just doesn't work in the same way from a brand perspective as it does if you slide back into the preschool or the 6 to 11 demographic.
If you're writing for children, you need to be thinking character, 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 and making the character distinct. It's not so much plot.
I would temper that slightly. At the younger end, as I said, sort of like picture books and early chapter books, etc., then yes, character. As you slide up the scale and you're moving into middle grade, the top end of middle grade, and YA, then for me, actually, no, story takes over. And I think it's the story world that you're creating. Then I have to pull back and go, no, if you're doing a book that is essentially sort of social realism, then actually it probably is the strength of the character within that real world and the particular journey experiences that they have that will push them through. So if you take Wonder, that's about character. The central character boy in that story is extremely sort of like powerful. If you move into another extreme sort of Hunger Games, I think Hunger Games, while Katniss is very strong character, it's actually the world that she's in that is the most compelling thing about the read. You know, you can find Katniss, that type of journey character, in a whole bunch of other YA stories that are out, or pretty close. What you can't find is basically kids doing gladiatorial combat and dying in order to prove who's the best. The bit that stood out, and then the imagination of the districts and the worlds, and then how that trilogy sort of came together. Publishing is not as simplistic in terms of creating brands as I think television is.
Nicola asked, is the market for children's fiction still growing?
As far as I'm concerned, yes. Whether that's a year-on-year growth in terms of the number of books, I haven't quite got enough experience to say. I'm out pitching new stories, etc., that I'm involved with, and I don't get any signs going up that we're full. All right. Everybody in every publishing house is still looking for new content. They don't appear to be cutting back on the number of titles, you know, that they say they're sort of publishing. So whether that's a significant growth, but I don't know. But I think, yes, I think the doors are open. People still want great characters, great stories. Everybody's competing to deliver the next big thing into the marketplace.
And I think for parents, there is still a feeling that it's important for children to read.
I would agree. And I think there's a debate within the publishing sector of kids media as to, are the good books and less good books? Do you know what I mean? In terms of, and as a somebody who's rubbed shoulders with publishers rather than being completely sort of embedded in their culture and ergo all the people associated with it, there's still a degree of snobbery about, is this a better quality picture book because it's an original idea, as opposed to you saying this came from a song and went viral on YouTube. Whereas I go, if the child is reading, they're reading, all right? Mm-hmm. They'll if the story is good for them, then the story it's a good story. So I think it's brilliant the more you can get books interconnected into kids' lives. And I think it's stronger for them when they see that the social media world, that they're, you know, if you've got a five-year-old now, the world of social media, YouTube, all that stuff, is their normality. For me, it wasn't part of my normality. But if you can connect books into that and not show that they're some sort of divorced part of their culture, all the better. That's just more powerful for publishing, basically.
What would you say to the people who complain that classic children's stories like Jungle Book, for example, have been Disneyfied and we've got Disneyfication?
It would depend on how polite or how much wine I'd had to say. I think that the Jungle Book is a great story, okay? But the difference is there are two versions of that story. The great story is the one that kids know, they've been sort of like Disneyfied, etc. But they tell the story of a boy who was adopted, you know, by animals, you know, all that sort of kind of stuff. Or there's the story as Rudyard Kipling, the words on the page and the images that he sort of like created. For me, it doesn't matter that children don't necessarily know his version of that story. I've not read it for ages. I would imagine that I would struggle to read it, you know, in terms, or if I was reading it to my children, I would, who are too old for it now anyway, that I'd be going, blimey, this is a bit of a stretch, basically, in terms of engaging with them. And I think you end up being on that classicist, purist end of the spectrum, going, this is the way that it should be experienced. And you go, for a whole bunch of children, what's the point of saying somehow they're having an inferior cultural experience because they're getting it through Disney? They understand the story and get a huge amount of fun out of it, then great. If that's not the pure version of how it was written on the page, it's just, yeah, that's people in the world of publishing just acting superior about words over pictures. It's about encouraging people to engage in story. If I'd have to go back and read Jungle Book and come back and do another interview and go, you know, this is why I don't think it should be held up. Somebody should be adapting it slightly to make it work for where kids are now, because it was written in a different time when language in schools was different, the whole kind of thing, when children's engagement span could be relied on more. A story has to compete unfortunately, it has to compete. I know publishers and people who write don't like this, but it is a competitive market. Publishers do need to make money. I know people don't like to talk about publishers needing to make money, but secretly they do have to make money, and they do like books that sell better than the ones that don't. I know it's a bit of a shock, but...
Tell me about your new company, Kickback Story.
Kickback Story. Okay, well, it's not quite a new company yet. It's a new initiative under sort of Kickback Media. It's probably come at the end of what is a sort of almost 30-year journey in children's media. I've always been fascinated by publishers because they don't develop anything. Now, that's a slight exaggeration. But compared to film and TV, there is no development department in a publisher, whereas any television company, small, medium or large, I mean, the development company could be the founder of the company because they're not a big company. But if it's a big company, then there will be a team of sort of maybe two or three people whose job specifically is to spot ideas, develop them, and then present them as new brands. And that's what Bob the Builder started. It was four pieces of paper in a drawer when I was working as head of development for HIT. I've always said to publishers, why didn't you develop anything? Why didn't you ever do development? Because it's the lifeblood of film and TV, spotting new ideas, creating stuff. And I've eventually realized after about 25 years is they just don't have the time, nor do they have the need. There is no need to do any development in publishing because there is an endless stream of finished product coming from agents. And the endless stream of finished product coming from agents comes from your listeners, if they're fortunate enough to write something that an agent wants. And an agent doesn't do any development. You know, it doesn't go, has anybody got any good ideas for a story? And so, you know, like, give me 100 words on an idea and then we'll develop it. And they don't do it because they haven't got any time either, because they've got enough finished product landing to them. They're spending all of their time rejecting stuff, avoiding reading new things, because they've got one slot out of 100 to fill. And that's how tough it is to find an agent to get into a publisher. But I never like to do what everybody else does. So I think there's a different way to create content. And so because I've spent 25 years developing ideas, and that's what I do, and I like to think I'm reasonably good at spotting a good idea that can be a character, can be, you know, a film pitch, which could be, you know, oh yeah, I had one which was Cat in the Hat meets Swiss Family Robinson. Okay, so I know what that is in my head and I know where it's sort of come from. But somebody pitched that to me and I'd go, Cat in the Hat meets Swiss Family Robinson. Okay, I'm thinking interesting character, causes chaos, family on a desert island, got there by mistake, discovered something. Right, okay, tell me more. That for me, there's an interesting story already. So that's kind of what I've decided to do. Go about 5 miles down the river of creativity from where agents stand at the top of the waterfall and intersect with ideas from writers at an early stage and help them develop the book, the idea. It is about books. And then I will attempt to go and sell it. It feels slightly disruptive because publishers don't really understand what I'm doing. They also have The View, which I find quite interesting. Good luck with that, basically. And the good luck with that is based on, I'll get shot for saying this, they really think that if you're a good writer, an agent will have found you. If you haven't been found by an agent, you can't be any good. So the people who I'm looking to work with clearly can't be any good. If they were good, they'd have an agent. And you kind of go, that's a bit like saying everybody who's got a record contract are the only good people who can sing. Because if you could sing, you'd have a record contract. How many talent shows have we got out there in the marketplace that are looking for new singers and prove that the people who are working in Tesco's, who when they stand up on the stage, open their mouth and it's the most amazing thing that comes out and they don't have a record contract. And without oversimplifying, writing is no different to that. There are dozens and hundreds of people out there who can write. I think the challenge is have they delivered a compelling story to an agent? Because you have to be able to write and deliver a compelling story that will fit into the marketplace at that moment when you finish it. And therein for me lies the issue for new writers. There are two very clear skill sets, I think. the ability to paint pictures with your words, and then the ability to have an idea and construct a totally compelling story and make no mistakes when you write it. Because if you make mistakes, too many, then the agent's job is to go, I'm afraid it's a no. But we really do like the way that you write, and we would love to hear from you in the future. And that's saying, that's close but no cigar. There's something there. I don't have the time to fix it, even though it could be fixed, because my business model says I just can't afford to commit the number of weeks and months and go back to you. And then I don't know whether you're even interested in changing the idea. So it has to be that, dear X, we really enjoyed reading, but on this occasion, unfortunately, it's a no. And we might give you a couple of reasons why, or we just go, it's just not quite what we're looking for at the moment. I'm sort of becoming more and more aware of how tough it is to make it as a writer as I go. I have a huge and increasingly daily, weekly, monthly respect for anybody who wants to become a writer or become an author, etc., in terms of the worlds that you have to sort of create. I'm bringing to bear, I guess, 25 plus years of experience of being in children's media, looking at stories, albeit different types of stories, because TV stories are very different. It's about creating 52 stories or 104 stories out of a precinct. You know, you set up Bob the Builder, or you set up Ninja Turtles, or you set up whatever it is, Ren and Stimpy, and then you go again and again and again. Same characters, same world, same moment in time. And it's a very different type of storytelling. There's no character evolution. Middle grade fiction, for me, you're doing a much more filmic story because you want your characters, central characters, to go on a big journey. Plus, you need to create an amazingly original, compelling environment. You know, I've done some film development back in the day, not so successfully, so it's not a complete ask for me. Personally, I pay a lot of attention to films, and you see how characters grow. You know their structure sort of relates to sort of middle grade sort of like fiction as well. And it's exciting because I like finding new talent. I like encouraging people. I'm an ex-primary school teacher, so maybe that's got something to do with that. And I had a sort of an epiphany at, I did work briefly for Bloomsbury, and there were a couple of projects that people were fighting over in the industry. One was Nevermore that came in, which I'm sure some of your listeners would have read or heard about. First time writer, she'd been writing it for, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 years. And it went massive in terms of there was a big publishing auction for it. I can remember reading in the Evening Standard it got picked up for a film option, 7-figure deal. And I'd read the book. Bloomsbury were trying to get hold of it, as were a whole bunch of others. And I thought, yeah, it's good, but it's not amazing. No offense, the author. It's not like I've never, ever seen anything like that before. I just thought, I'm sure I've seen ideas like that, you know, that have been around that have got that kind of potential. And what struck me was she was a first-time author. And I thought, no one's asking what else has she written. Because what you'll find in television, everybody goes, what else have they written? And you go, well, this, they're a first-time writer. And it's like, and they'll want to bring in people who've got lots of experience. Whereas in all the meetings, when Bloomsbury were looking at it, nobody ever put their hand up going, excuse me, she's not written a book before. And it was quite simple because, no, she's just written the book. That's it's there. We can judge it. We don't need to know whether she's written anything before. It's there on the page. And hopefully she will have worked out what book two and book three is. And that was a sudden light bulb of going, you can be a first-time writer and it's not a problem for a publisher. And in fact, it could be a bonus because, no offense to established writers, if your sales history is essentially flat after your first book, it's the equivalent of ever so slightly going backwards. You know, you're not building. And therefore, there is always the opportunity cost because there's only so many authors the publisher can have. And everybody wants authors whose sales are building. Book one starts you off. Book two takes you to next place, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you're new, then actually when the sales director or the sales team goes out into the marketplace, new is the promise of excitement and newness. If you're taking an author out who is on book four, but their sales have been consistently at a level, but not stellar, selling book four into the retailer is a real challenge because the retailer knows exactly what they're going to get. And it's not bad, but it's not exciting.
What kind of stories are you looking for?
If people haven't worked it already, I am looking for sort of high concept stuff. It's a massively competitive market. All of your listeners, every writer knows how tough it is to get an agent. I don't have any I have some contacts, etc., but I can't make it any less competitive. The only way that I can compete is to try and deliver stories, story worlds that people haven't seen before. You know, that are a mashup of two things, you know, that go, oh, that sounds really interesting. And I come from a TV background or a media background. So I want stories that I can almost pitch in that two movie phrase. Like there's one I'm developing at the moment, and it ended up being pitched as Stranger Things meets X-Men. And people go, oh, I want to see what that is. Do you know what I mean? They know what it is, and I only just about know what it is because the writer's halfway through it and we haven't quite finished it off. But I do know it has elements of Stranger Things, and it definitely has elements of X-Men in terms of non-straightforward sort of human sort of like beings. And I'm unashamedly commercial. I'm sorry. The object is, after 30 years in kids' media and not being hideously wealthy, I'm doing this to make money. I am not doing this to win prizes. That would be a bonus, but unlikely. This is about really commercial fiction, but with extremely powerful high concept story worlds. And with that will have to come really strong characters, because you can't pull off the high concept fantasy world unless your character goes on a really, real roller coaster of a journey and come out being a different character, like we know a brilliant character should do. And so it's magical fantasy, dystopian, although people think dystopian's finished, which is usually a sign that it's probably a couple of years from coming back in some shape or form. Sci-fi, horror, and exaggerated comedy, which is, I think, the toughest, not only because David Walliams is just dominating the marketplace, and then every other stand-up comedian you can write is delivering content into that marketplace. But it is really difficult to deliver comedy that isn't overly British, overly pun-based, overly toilet humour. You can have all of those elements in it, but if you want something that's really going to connect with the rest of the world, you do have to leave your puns behind and step outside of the toilet for a lot of your gags. It has to become character, character-led. And I think that's where TV animation comedy is good. The international level is driven by the US, and they are the best at delivering character comedy for 6 to 11s. Nowhere comes anywhere near. You know, we can say the UK is the best for preschool, generally speaking, but once you want to do comedy for sort of 6 plus, North America, and I guess I've got some training from watching, looking, trying to sort of emulate that, to poke writers and go, no, it needs to be a sharper character, it needs to be a better dynamic. That's just a lazy gag. And it's very easy to dismiss animation and cartoons as just sort of, you know, TV sort of like fodder. But if you look at the construction of some of the best Cartoon Network series or Nickelodeon, some of their sort of big hits, and actually almost like not quite frame by frame, but look at it scene by scene, how the gags are set up, how much they're sort of burning through the amount of story, the fact that you've got two plots and the episodes are only 11 minutes, there's an awful lot sort of going on there in terms of that banter. You can't necessarily translate it straight into your story, but the sharpness of characters, I think, and the cleverness, the layers of references that they bring in, I think as a professional exercise, anybody who wants to write comedy should do some research and look at those, and sort of also tune their comedy ear into some of the, for the dialogue especially, because they're clearly, you know, there's no description in there, but for dialogue and how characters play off each other, I think you can definitely learn quite a lot from that. That might be horrific to a lot of, you know, authors. You're naive to think that if you're saying, oh, I'm writing comedy for sort of your average 8-year-old, and you go, okay, your 8-year-old will read, let's say, 10 books in a year, they will consume 1,000 hours of animation in that year, all right? Mm-hmm. Can't go, well, yeah, when they're watching TV, their version of funny is different to when they're reading a book. They recognise funny, and they know what good funny is. Mm-hmm. And the benchmark that they're being set is when they're laughing out loud at a TV series. So when they turn to a book to read, which we want them to do, you are patronising them if you think somehow you don't need to be as sharp with your dialogue and your situations as what they've got on YouTube or straightforward TV if they're sort of watching it, because they're not discriminating in the way that you might be, because we're all 20 years older than them, or 30 or 40 or 50 years older than them.
Well, and, yeah.
I was starting low and sort of working up. And I think there is that mistake. And again, thin ice talking to writers, et cetera, is that children don't discriminate in the same way that I think people do who say, I want to write books. I don't want to write television because somehow that's grubby and, you know, whatever, whatever. Yeah. Don't give a monkeys, you know, they just want to be entertained in the same way whenever they move to a different medium. Mm-hmm. And if you do them a disservice and you do the whole industry a disservice if you sort of undersell what publishing needs to be in that space. Mm-hmm. The email address, if anybody wants to contact me, is inquiries@new-authors.co.uk.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks very much. That's been brilliant.
You're very welcome.
That's great. I found it really interesting when you were saying that the younger children's stuff has to start with the graphic design, has to start with the look of the thing. And also when he was saying how hard it was in that market to move from a story into a brand, which is, you always assume that everything starts in story, but perhaps it doesn't.
Well, I think he would start from any point. It could be visual, it could be story, it could be just
could
an
be
idea.
Character, yeah.
And he's interested in development, and this is one of the things that he criticises the publishing industry for, as you'll have heard.
Yes, he was quite scathing.
They don't do development. They just want you to give them a finished product, and if it's not perfect for their needs, they reject it.
Yeah.
And I also picked up on where he said, you know, you have to contact 100 agents to get one that might take you, which is pretty much on par for the numbers we've been given by other people.
Yeah. And remember some time ago we did that bit about you have to have 100 rejections before you...
Oh, yes.
It just keeps coming back.
So,
And he is open to submissions.
As
you'll have heard.
So if you've got anything to pitch to him.
Any original ideas.
Yeah. Mm. The new Peppa Pig.
Somebody's got to come up with it.
Let's hope it's one of you.
Well, it's nearly time to wrap up for this week. But before we do, there's just time for Heather and Judith Hennigan to tell us what's on their bedside tables. Heather?
Well, we might have talked about this one before, because I actually borrowed the book from Stephanie. But it's called This Is Going to Hurt by Adam Kay. Mm-hmm. And it's the diary of a junior doctor. And for me, after spending more than 40 years working in the NHS, I can relate to all of the situations he describes. I've laughed so much and cried a few tears along the way. It'll make you realise just how hard junior doctors work and all the rest of the staff in the NHS. I won't spoil his jokes, but I highly recommend this book. It was a brilliant read.
It's hitting the bestseller list.
I was going to say, it's absolutely racing up the bestseller list.
Well, I borrowed it from Steph too, and I laughed.
I've really annoyed my husband because I've been reading it in bed.
Oh.
And I've just laughed so much. He's just been.
And then you go, what? And then you have to read your bed. It's never as funny when you read it.
And the bed's shaky too.
Quite a few influencers have picked up on this, I've noticed, especially in the Brighton area. Lots of chatter on Twitter about it. Mm-hmm. And people absolutely loving it.
Yes, it is so funny. Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yes.
Well, thanks, Heather. Now let's hear from Judith Hennigan.
I have an enormous pile of books on my bedside table because I have to read lots of books for work. I read books that my students have published. I read books that I need to research for my teaching. But there are always a couple of books on my bedside table that are for me, that no one, I don't have to read. They're not on a list of things I'm supposed to read. And I call it my secret reading. And my daughter, who works in a bookshop, she's wonderful because she's forever recommending books to me and buying me books. And she knows what I like. And she has no idea what I need to read for work, but she knows what I like to read in my secret reading. And so one of the books that she gave me for Christmas, which I'm only just getting around to now, is Deborah Levy's living memoir, she calls it. And the title is The Cost of Living. And it's actually the second book in a sequence. It's got this glorious, sunny, yellow cover. I love Deborah Levy. I loved her books, her fiction, Swimming Home, and also a novel called Hot Milk, and a short story collection called Black Vodka. I would like to say that she's influenced my writing. I do feel influenced by her. But this memoir, The Cost of Living, is, for me, I feel she's speaking to me right now, because she's talking about being a woman in her 50s who has brought up a family, she's been married, she's now divorced, and she's saying, actually, how can I be a writer in the world? What's the cost of being a writer? And how can I pursue that in a way that feels true and meaningful for me? Now, at times, it's quite wry at times about some of the obstacles that she faces. And she creates these little vignettes that are ostensibly about other people, but actually, of course, she's writing about herself. I don't know. It really speaks to me right now, and I'm really enjoying it. So that's my secret reading.
Sadly, that's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. Thanks for listening. Next week, we'll be talking to the fabulous Sarah Bauer about short story writing. Don't forget to subscribe on Radio Public, iTunes or Stitcher, so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want. And please take a few minutes to leave us a 5-star review, or drop by our Facebook group and introduce yourself. Keep sharing the love by introducing friends to Write Club, the podcast. Goodbye!
Bye! Bye.